Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
This is Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Alpha Muhammad II, filling in for my father, Imam Alpha Muhammad, who had to step aside. Once again, Imam Alpha Muhammad will be on the show tomorrow, on Friday, to do his daily broadcast. But before I play a replay, I'd like to tell the audience listening currently that Religion Means Alive, the replay is about to go on. There'll be a slight pause. In between, I don't know why, but for some reason it was just a pause. I don't know, maybe it's technical difficulties that day, but yeah, that's it is what it is. So just urging you to stay on because the show will go on when I play it. So just stick to the show and you'll be good.
Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, greetings, peace and blessings. This is Asafo Hakeem Shakur Ami here. Thank you all for tuning in, listening in. You're tuning in to the Honorable One here. I am broadcasting live out of Virginia, by the way of Baltimore, Maryland. So I thank you all for taking this opportunity. You're on Religion Means Alive Radio on Blog Talk here, and I want to thank Imam Alfred Muhammad for allowing for me to bless this show here evening. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to speak a little bit about myself and let everyone know just what's going on in Baltimore and give just a overview of the challenges that many of us have faced as a people and in our community and the challenges that we must overcome. And so before I get into much of that, I would like to speak a little about myself here and share just what exactly, you know, my experiences have been so you can get a good and greater feel for just where I am and how I came to be, you know, who I am today and where I am. I want to thank a few individuals, of course, for allowing for me, Brother Bilal, who a few months ago I had the opportunity actually to come to Paterson, New Jersey, where I was on a panel with Brother Morad Muhammad, and he and I and another brother, you know, we laid out some key, what I believe some very key initiatives and strategies and analysis that certainly could be empowering. And hopefully I know they have some clips running around or going around of that actual recording. But I want to thank Baba Imam for allowing for me to do this show. I'm actually en route to Durham, North Carolina. And then I'm actually heading to Winston-Salem with Dr. Joe L. Dudley of Dudley Hair Care Products. He's having his 80th anniversary, 80th year of living here, and, you know, 50 years of entrepreneurship. Dudley Hair Care Products, multi-million dollar operation. And this is, you know, he's certainly one that is concerned about young black males, and so he invited young black males to actually come here, you know, for free. And so he's been doing this conference for every year, and I have not been actually to a Dudley conference ever, but I've met him and did some trainings with Dr. Joe L. Dudley. And so, and of course, I want to just thank again, all praises due to Baba Imam for allowing for me to join you here this afternoon or late evening as well. For those who may be on the West Coast, it's early afternoon, shall I say. I guess you may be 4 o'clock over there. But I'm here in Baltimore, Maryland. Well, by the way, Baltimore, traveling to North Carolina, in Virginia right now. And so, and I was born and raised in Baltimore, to make a long story short. And there, I always tell people there's a Baltimore and a Baltimore-less. And unfortunately, at one particular time, I was part of the Baltimore-less, you know, and coming up in an urban environment, yes, I did have both of my parents. They were around. They were not necessarily together for the full duration of my upbringing, though. My father always was around. He was always there when I needed him. I didn't necessarily ask for a whole lot. My mother was pretty, you know, independent in a sense that, you know, we didn't want for much, though. He always was there if I asked him for it. Never denied me anything, and he was a strong role model in a sense of teaching me to work. Yes, work. That is what I was taught to do. He was former Army part-time or weekend warrior, if you will, as well as a postal worker for 37 years. So the civil servants ran in my family. And, you know, I took that, some aspects of that, but, you know, the lure of the streets actually could play a great role into the minds of people, and particularly young black males. I was a product of the hip-hop generation, and I was highly influenced by both the negative as well as the many of the positive attributes. And I attest and I affirm that, boy, hip-hop music can have an adverse or negative effect on young people if there's not the balance in a controlled environment. Sometimes young people, you know, I've seen them actually be almost like a possession by this spirit. And so we have to begin, when we look at development, of course, we take our own experiences, but, you know, we have to just make objective reasoning decisions and say, like, what are you putting into your mind? And, you know, whatever your inputs are going to be your outputs. And so I say that coming up in an urban environment in Baltimore, the lure of the streets, you know, many of my peers, I knew they made some of the wrong decisions and they made some right decisions. But, you know, it becomes subjective on many different levels, because sometimes our standards of how we see life or how we perceive life tend to be very limited. We only think based upon what our peers or our friends or what we see the others do. We don't tend to set our own parameter in terms of where and what we can actually achieve. And so I was a part of that, and I had several experiences growing up. I wasn't necessarily attending school, and I'm not going to, you know, spend the whole show talking about, you know, my background and what I did, but suffice to say, you know, I was a Freddie Gray on some different levels. And for those who may not know, Freddie Gray is the young brother who was killed or murdered, however we want to say it, by the Baltimore City police officers, and they were just charged in, all of them, all six of the officers were charged in this case. And so I was downtown today. You know, there was, I don't know, people called it a protest. Some people called it a victory celebration. I just say it's people getting together to vent, and that could be good on some levels, but it has to be directed. It has to be truly directed towards constructive development, I believe, because I believe sincerely that warfare and, you know, the destruction of a people is in their hearts and in their mind. And we have to begin to look at what we are feeding ourselves and what, you know, both nutritionally as well as mentally, and how we are managing our time and our values. Because sometimes we take in other people's or other values that do not reflect best practices for preserving our life, our freedom, and our future economic opportunity. And so we have to ask ourselves what values we are in taking in. And so coming up, I had some life experiences again on the streets, and I knew some pretty hardcore brothers and sisters, and, well, mostly brothers, and what sisters were like gangster at that time, like the young people would say now. You got some young females running around. Oh my God, have you seen that video? Young M.A. is her name. Somewhere up in New York, talking about Brooklyn, and how many gats, you know, a little lesbian. Oh my gosh, just totally gone. Young M.A., it's all around. People been showing it, talking about how many people she going to take out. Little, look like she about 18, 19 years old. I'm like, oh my God, this is scary. So I realized that sometimes, you know, perpetual enslavement and cultural degradation will lead to many destructive practices, and it's all infiltrated all throughout the rap music industry. And so I'm not that I'm going to spend much time talking about rap music and hip-hop or, you know, however we want to define it, but the reality is that it is a adverse force, creates stereotypes in other people's perception that we are savages, and that may validate or justify or give reasoning that we are animals or they are animals, if you will. And so we have to enhance our imagery. And so coming up here, you know, fortunately, I had my brother around, and my brother gave me an empowering book. It was Hakeem Edebuddy's Black Men Single, Dangerous, Obsolete. He gave me that book, and one thing I took from that book was reading should be like eating and sleeping. And so from there, you know, I said, if reading should be like eating and sleeping, how much are we reading? How much are we sleeping? We're sleeping 6, 7, 8 hours a day, a night, shall I say. Well, maybe we should be reading that much. And so I went. I was angry, still bitter, but I realized that through knowledge I could become better. And so I made the decision to read, and after beginning to read a few books, one book, two books, I got on a disciplined reading regimen. I began to love knowledge and the search for knowledge in many different places and spaces. And, of course, I'm always still searching for knowledge. And sometimes knowledge can take you on different places where you may not necessarily want to go. You know, you're searching, you want to read different things. And I always tell a little joke. Sometimes, you know, I was reading, and I ended up reading a Elin Harris book. And I was like, okay. And then I read a second book, and I was like, wait a minute, this guy's talking about another gay book. I was like, I don't need to read too much of this no more. I mean, reading is good, but sometimes you just got to be like, no. So I see there's a lot of urban literature you know, running around, and, you know, sometimes you got to be very conscious of your time in terms of your reading comprehension. And so I would encourage everyone to do just that. So that's what I did, and reading 100 books a year just before I went, before I graduated high school. And that was almost like the first time that I really began to read books that really, truly intrigued me, that intrigued my spirit in terms of that I can become someone, that I can become better, that I can do better. And so I read many different books, from psychology to history, you know, to economics, business. And I used the pattern or the behavior or the history of, shall I say, of what Frederick Douglass did, as well as Malcolm X. I read about Frederick Douglass. He used to run away, and sometimes he actually learned how to read from a little white child. A little white child taught him how to read, and he would, like, steal parts of tore-up newspapers and put them together at times, and he would learn how to read. And I said to myself, he learned how to read that way, you know, knowing that we've been deprived of knowledge, and I had been deprived of knowledge. I knew that I needed to take knowledge seriously. And I can't recall which I read first or last, but reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, where
Malcolm actually read the dictionary cover to cover. Yes.
And that was totally inspiring to me. I never actually thought about that, how our language and the language that we use can determine our destiny. It determines our thoughts. And so with that as the backdrop for motivating, being inspired to reading people like Dr. Naeem Akbar and Dr. Welsing, and, you know, many of the prominent black historians, Dr. John Henry Clark and several others, I began to realize that, of course, I feel strong about the history, feel strong about psychology and knowledge of self. I realized that I needed to prepare for my future. And so I tried to translate what I learned. And I read a brother, and many of you all who are in the New Jersey area or in the Philadelphia area, certainly, but definitely in Jersey, you know of Brother George Sabur. George Sabur wrote several books: Black Folks' Guide to Selling, Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, Successful Business. I mean, these books were some of the pioneers. And actually, when I just had a training with Dr. Willie Jolly, and what's interesting, Dr. Willie Jolly, for those who may not know, he's internationally known motivational speaker, speaks all over the world, author of Set Up is a Setback for a Comeback, and, you know, several other prominent books, best-selling authors. And he said that he used to meet with George Sabur. And so it's just very interesting. He used to meet with George Sabur. George Sabur would travel down to Washington, D.C. Matter of fact, he said when his book first came out, George Sabur was one of the first persons that he actually went to, you know. So, and, you know, it's interesting because everything comes back. Many people may not know I was a part of the MATA network, which is a black channel distribution. And it seems like everybody knew who George Sabur was, like old school elders, like between the ages of 50 and 70. If they were talking about black economic business empowerment, they knew who George Sabur was, especially on the East Coast, but definitely in the Philly. And I believe he may have been in Camden, New Jersey area, but he has certainly been someone that has inspired my teachings. And what did he say in that book? He said that he early in the 70s, he was a part of Malanga Karenga's group, Us, United Slaves, or I believe that's what they called themselves out in California. But the founder of Kwanzaa, shall say, many people know him from that. But he said that many of the cultural teachings and the cultural individuals, and he even criticized Hakim Adabudi's book and said that out of all the books that Hakim Adabudi talked about, he didn't specify or mention any business books. And he said that's kind of hard to believe that you're going to know and all the history and everything, what happened, but not know basic finances. So I began to balance, you know, the cultural, historic, psychological knowledge with understanding that there needed to be a cultural understanding of the role of economics in building and developing our community. And so I, later realizing that finance is the language, as Malcolm X spoke about, the language of our community, that I needed to be financially literate. I needed to know the language of finance. And so what I did what Malcolm did. But I read a financial dictionary cover to cover. Yeah. So going back, when I graduated, I went directly into the United States Navy. I did 5.5 years active duty, and I kept reading. I mean, I had a lot of time, fortunately. I had a lot of time when I was there, and I just kept reading, and 2 books a week, and sometimes 3 books, different books over and over sometimes. But I was consistent and persistent with reading, and that led to my transformation. And so upon being discharged, came back to Baltimore, and this is what I've been, like, letting folks know, like, what happened once I got back, because I came back, I was in Norfolk, Virginia, San Diego, California, came back to Baltimore, and I was ready. I was ready to organize and thought that things was going to be easy, but they were not as easy as I imagined. Sometimes I would, you know, I didn't have the structural, the mentorship, the training with someone guiding you properly to know what your options were. I knew some things. I knew a little bit about network marketing. Fortunately, I connected to a network marketing company when I just before I got discharged, ACN, American Communications Network. So that was a good, awesome experience. But later, when I got out, came back to Baltimore, I kind of got into some other things like Noni Juice, and I was building a local clinic with Brother General Satu Muhammad. Anybody know him? He's from New York, but definitely someone. He used to work in the Sandtown, Winchester area. So I've worked with several different individuals who, you know, scholars. That's where I began to see. He showed me all of his books, and I was like, wow. You know, when you see someone with a house full of books, not a house full of big screen televisions, but a house full of hundreds of books, thousands of books, it's inspiring. No matter what the books may what they speak on, but it is certainly inspiring to see individuals read that much. And, you know, and that brings up the point that, and where I want to push some people, because, you know, there are some elders out here that, you know, they've read a lot of history and things and this nature and that, but they haven't developed resources. They haven't developed the basic foundation of manhood, you know, and we have to teach our young people this early as possible to not let anything come and destroy your life, your freedom, or your future economic opportunity. I learned this later, you know, working in the Sandtown area. I don't know if I mentioned it, but I used to write for, I was assistant editor for the Sandtown Winchester Viewpoint newspaper. As well, a little later, I worked for what's called Youth Opportunities of Yo Baltimore. And so from these two, I began to see the dynamics of youth challenges and why youth were not employed or underemployed, and I covered some different stories within that area organize and shut down some a Korean store that was selling bad meat. Yes, with not with the angry act, but little old women, little old church women who wanted to not let this bad meat get sold in an urban poor environment. And that was right on the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue, so I covered that story. I mean, I was doing journalist work, but I got the word out about that, and we organized with one of the local council people. And so that is kind of like the foundation for some of the work that has transformed me to be able to know what's going on in Baltimore, the level of poverty, the level of frustration, the anger, the rage. And there's actually a book called Black Rage by some black psychologists. That was one of the books that I read some years ago, Ellis Cole and maybe Kenneth someone. But Ellis Cole, it was a real popular book. I believe they are psychologists. You know, it speaks about the frustration that's happening within black people. And we have to not let some of these, these historical inequalities frustrate us to the point where we act. So we have to move towards intellectual development, because that's where, you know, and that's what I learned from the power of reading. How slavery, you know, it was against the law to read, and they would kill you to read, keep you just as ignorant, and they're still doing that in the prison system. And I read Mumia Abu-Jamal's book some years ago. He talked about, I believe, how in certain institutions, how they didn't have books. And basically, it was organized in such a way to keep people from learning. And so I'm just saying that knowledge is what's going to free a large percentage of us. And how we get that knowledge, we have to pursue knowledge and excellence with precision. Pursue it in a very determined, focused, disciplined, no-nonsense way, you know, to prepare ourselves and to prepare our children to be competitive in this society. Bottom line, Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington mentioned, and I started to say that today, Booker T. Washington mentioned how others say things about voting. He said, we got $364 that we can use every single day. And so the question is, how do you get that education and use it to apply within your own life? And so with that being said, that the backdrop, and let me get into this Freddie Gray case, because I feel that since many people want to hear what's going on in Baltimore, it's a tough situation. And I, you know, objectively speaking, I don't know what the legalities may be, you know, so I listen to a lot of different, a broad spectrum of opinions to get at what may be coming, because you gotta be prepared for whatever. And I like to tell people, and like this fool on radio today said something about, well, if black businesses got burned down, so what? Like, how about your damn mama house getting burned down? How the hell would you like that? Let's just think about what we say out our mouths. You know, if black businesses get burned down, so what? So I don't have anything to do with some things, but if my house get burned down, where I got to live and my children, you know, for other things that just happen. And let me make this plain, because you ignorant Negroes didn't listen to me. Now I'm saying listening to me, because I've been working in the Baltimore area, putting in some significant work. And you just going to say, if a black person's business get burned down, huh? That don't make no sense, brother. You know, we got to really, you know, watch how we, you know, in our, what's the term? You know, trying to be strong and try to be militant. You know, sometimes you just say things You just say things and not think about them, not think about the results, the cause and effect. Because you can't, like, bottom line is we don't have the luxury of allowing for some of our valuable institutions shut down. And so that's why, you know, I personally was, I came down and I was encouraging others to come down to Everyone's Place bookstore. You know, one of our major institutions in Baltimore, and should be perceived as a major institution, definitely within the East Coast, just for the significant number of books, quality books that it may have. Now, this bookstore, it's not just a bookstore. You know, they have other things, but I believe that the quality of the books and some of the authors, see, that's what's happening. It's about distribution. As a Mata person, for those who may not know, Mata is a channel of distribution for black manufactured products, and that's why I'm going back down to reconnect with Dr. Joel Dudley, because we were attempting to get form an alliance or a partnership with Dr. Joel Dudley and his distributors to distribute more products and to raise our consciousness and redirect 10% consumption spending. At that time, it was $600 billion. Now it's about maybe 0.1 or somewhere around between $900 billion and $1 trillion of black spending power. It just goes away. It just goes to anything and everything, frivolously, in most cases. So the Mata channel, so we were attempting to partner with Dr. Joel Dudley, and we had books, and this is where I was like, so if I have, I was thinking like this, Ken Bridges and Mr. Al Wellington, the CEO and founders of the Mata Network, both were Wharton MBA grads from University of Pennsylvania, and, you know, they pushed conscious books, you know, they pushed the work of George Frazier, pushed the books of Dr. Claude Anderson. I was like, so you have some sharp MBA grads who were previous, one was previously a diamond in Amway, you know, but bringing the cultural, historic understandings and trying to create a black channel of distribution, you know, branded, proper professional branding, and knowing marketing as sophisticated as they do, knowing and understanding financing. They had Dr. Walter P. Lomax, in Pennsylvania, the owner of WRD Word 900 AM, which I will be on tomorrow night, if I may add, at 7 p.m. So I'll be dropping the word on word about BMOR, the Battle of BMOR. The Walter P. Lomax, a very prominent medical doctor, but also the owner of and a philanthropist within the Philadelphia area. Many people know him, know of his work, you know, of his philanthropy work throughout the Philadelphia area. He was financing it. He was financing the Mata Network. And I got to tell this history a little bit before I spend the next half talking about, you know, what's going on in Baltimore. But it lays the foundation of why I've been projecting myself in terms of posturing and knowing, like, look, you can listen to who you want, but I'm telling you, you know, I'm reading the right books, building with the right people, showing up at the right place. That's what it's going to be about. For those that do not know how to lock arms and do not bring something to the table, you're going to be left out. I've been promoting two books recently, and I would encourage everybody to get it. You know, on Amazon, you probably can get it for $1 or something. You know, Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein and Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You will get from those books a very global analysis of the contemporary corporations and how global power is being shifted throughout the world, and how corporations maneuver in, for instance, what's called third world countries. And I say, as many people understand, there's only a slight variation policy from an economic perspective that many global corporations have, for instance, in third world countries like Africa, as well as Latin America and the Caribbean, than what they have here for black Americans. So I understand that dynamic, how, you know, how they do things or have done things colonially speaking. But the only difference is that we, black, as black people, we are right here. So they, the idea, there's a contradiction. You know, you can only exploit the people that are actually here, right here with you, but so much before it reaches a level of instability. And this is what's happening in Baltimore. You know, you have people who feel so outside of mainstream society, outside of that they are willing. They feel they have no stake, no vested interest. And I guess that's what the brother speaking about. Like, so what if it burned down black businesses? That's what he said. But I'm like, how you going to talk about Tulsa, Oklahoma on one end, And Durham and Brownsville and all these other little small cities, and then you talk about, well, if they burn down the black business, whatever. So like, you won't even have it one way. You gonna build something up and protect it like other people would protect theirs. How would it look? Like, if someone came up to everyone's place and we'd just be like, oh, yeah, y'all black, so go ahead and set the damn thing on fire. You know? We need stuff. We need buildings. We need institutions, particularly that institution. I mean, I'm not going to get into the, you know, and I've been rather quiet in terms of the in-depth politics, because you got people in all spectrums of, you know, some, I saw a Maryland Republican delegate, or yes, he's a delegate, say to stop the riots, we need to cut off their food stamps. how you going to cut off somebody's food stamps like in a couple hours? Like, what does that mean? You know, or no, he agreed with a caller who said that. Like, So this is the mindset. So my thing is, okay, if these individuals have their way, for instance, that think like that, what's going to happen to those in urban environments? My thoughts is we need to create training programs, bottom line. I mean, it may not necessarily come through the government, you know. So the question is, if your so-called representatives that are in office, if they're not, you know, allocating the budget resources towards certain things, and let me just be clear, I'm not one to just throw money on a problem, because there are people out here who just want to throw money at some things, and next thing you know, some people got a bunch of flat-screen televisions, they have more car rims, Shaniqua, you know, can get her hair and everything else done. Not to say you can't, you know, beautify yourself, but, you know, you want to go down to the casino and gamble. And so I saw another piece that came out that wanted to restrict individuals for things like getting tattoos, things like, casinos, playing a lottery, and one was drinking alcohol. I was like, yeah. Yeah, if you want to do that, I'm like, shouldn't any logical leader, black leader, be against that? Really? You don't want welfare? Because on the other end of that, I was reading about, you can Google him, Coach Powell, who wrote 40-ounce scandal. And now somebody just posted something regarding that, how malt liquor disproportionately affects and creates anger and rage within a particular individual. And so what I recognize is that, yes, I'm not going to be upset about cutting out people from spending money on malt liquor. Huh? This is the backdrop of what's going on in Baltimore. You know, the challenges that we have and the so-called leaders, whether it's the so-called activist leaders that cannot move towards development, know operations and opportunities, and be humble, and know what you do not know, and know what you need to know in order to move our people forward and to move yourself forward. Because eventually, bottom line, it's going to be your decision. We all have some level of free will. As much as society would like to control everybody's thinking, you have to define your own thoughts. You have to be the definer of what you think, and with the help of your God. So that's where, you know, individual initiative come in, and reading and studying and being rather philosophical and thinking about what's going on, using whatever spiritual guidelines and teachings, that hopefully there are some good ones. There are some really extremism on many different religious groups and organizations. So we have to, everything within some level of moderation, take whatever makes sense from any and every doctrine. I don't want to sound like I'm proselytizing or any particular thing, but bottom line is that culture is not stagnant, and religion shouldn't be stagnant, if I may. You know, religion and culture should move people in a group forward in a contemporary sense, with that which keeps you alive and free and enhances your total quality of life. And what makes you think that you don't deserve it? You know, you have to look within yourself and say you deserve better. You know, as much as others may not want you to feel like you deserve, you have to create. You have to work towards and build that, and study your environment. Study where you are right now and make some proper decisions. Make some proper decisions towards your future. And certain key books, and I would say, yes, get my book. And I haven't talked about that, but Mission Unstoppable, Extraordinary Stories of Failure's Blessings. It's a co-authored book that myself and Les Brown and Dr. George Frazier, we co-authored that. And how I got that opportunity, actually about 2 years ago, I went to a power networking conference by the encouragement of some groups down in Prince George's County. And I had the opportunity to go to this conference, and George Frazier, who I certainly have read his books from years ago, he was promoting for this book, and I was like, well, why am I really here? Why am I at this conference? And then as he was speaking about the books, for those who may not know, again, for years I have been selling books as well. For years, a variety, mostly business, empowerment, consciousness, history, several different books, you know, spiritual growth, several different books, whatever would sell, actually, but mostly good quality books, not no silly foolishness, that urban lit stuff. I never touched yet. But we need to certainly read. And so going to this conference again, it just made sense. I've seen a lot of books just sitting for years and years and years. And I used to ask myself, well, why? You know, people publishing these books and they're just sitting there, people not buying them, and people waste a lot of money. I'm like, a lot of folks, they should have just, like, kept these books. They should have just kept these books in their mind and you know, kind of did an article or something. For real. you know, but people threw away a lot of money just letting the book sit. Now I said, you know, this is a good opportunity, first and foremost, you know. I mean, to be a co-author with individuals who have sold thousands of books and tens of thousands of books and hundreds of thousands of books, and certainly perhaps 1 or 2 million combined between Les Brown and George Frazer. They have both sold a significant number several times over, I'm sure. So I said, you know, let me look at that. I think, you know, that is the next stage for me. That is the next move. Frazer was in Hidden Colors. Many people know him from there. And his book, Success Within Our Race, was his most popular book. You know, it does the Power Networking Conference. And actually next month in June, I'll be at the Power Networking Conference for the third year. So big, I can't even explain the knowledge that I'm going to get again. You know, it's just going to be ridiculous. You know, I'm just going to another total level from going there and the knowledge that I'm going to get. So look that up, Power Network Conference. But so this book, I mean, you know, I'll share my story, some of the things I spoke about today, a little bit more in detail, but, you know, very well-written piece. It's just $20. You can get it on my site, successscholarhaki.com. Definitely, I would say, definitely get that book for me. And, you know, so, yeah, so I've been selling books and, you know, and I thought, like, okay, yeah, we need to look at, I mean, many black bookstores are shutting down. It's only like 54 of them in the country right now. And this is a key one. So I came there and I had a few other brothers showed up, a few other smart brothers in Baltimore showed up, you know, while everybody else trying to get to the cameras as fast as they can. You know, there were a few brothers that said, you know what, this bookstore is important. And I offered to take all of those brothers to dinner. I was only like 6 or 7 of them. I said, I will take all of you brothers to dinner when I find all of them. But I just believe that it was that important for us to keep our institution. And so with this Freddie Gray case, I know I keep mentioning coming back, but with this Freddie Gray case, police, you know, many officers, I don't want to say all or, you know, there's just this culture of denial. I'm sorry, not a culture of denial, but yes, there's a culture of denial, but there's a culture of lack of respect, you know, and value that is instituted. And in this particular case, the young man wasn't given medical treatment. Now, I don't know the legalities of what's going to happen, but definitely he did request medical treatment several times, and they didn't seat him down correctly. I mean, that caused the actual injury. So if anything, they may not have intended, because I know some folk, well, did they intend to murder him? No, they didn't intend to murder him. But on another level, you don't have to intend, and I believe it may be manslaughter, you know, to do something. You driving a car, you don't intend to run somebody over, but it may be different when someone, because you physically, you know, when you have someone in custody, you are responsible for their basic care. But then it was an illegal arrest. That is the thing. If you arrested, if he's illegally arrested, then you may have some grounds. You may have some grounds right there, but an illegal arrest, that's not going to sit. Yeah. So that's definitely not going to stick. You know, the arrest was legal. You didn't strap him in. Did not give them medical attention. Those are some of the key points. And, you know, I don't want to get into the argument of first degree and second degree. I mean, I've sat in some juries. I've, you know, studied a few little things, but I can't speak on what a jury is going to find, you know, the intent. But it was negligence, if anything. What is it, malfeasance or, you know, while misconduct in duty, I'm sorry, misconduct. So they were charged with that. And I feel that how can you say whether justice will be served? Some people say, well, they should go to jail forever. And, you know, I mean, I can't say, you know, what should happen to another individual. Because, again, no, they may not set out in their heart, we're going to kill him. We're going to kill him. But they didn't like him. So they knew who he was. They were just like, oh, just go ahead and get him in there. Just lay on your late hog tied, hands behind your back, hands tied up like a hog, legs in your back, laying on his stomach on the ground. So, yes, it's possible that he could have slid into something, I guess. That's what, you know, why he was on the floor. So that's what's happening with that particular case in Baltimore. And so my thing is, I'm going to deal with issues on the front end versus how others want to try to deal with everything on the back end. I want to prevent young people from even getting into these altercations, you know, these type of interactions with law enforcement officers. That's my goal. That's what I believe should be our priority, because we're not going to, and yes, things do happen, like the most blatant police situation was the gentleman. And I think that flared up things more. The case where the police officer just shot the man in the back, the black man in the back for running, you know, that was the most blatant, probably broke, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. That perhaps was something that made people realize that was like caught on camera. That is the most vicious thing, that the wake-up call, you know, the Houston, there's a problem call for many in the black community. And there's been lawyers who saying that Baltimore per capita is the most police abusive police department in this country. And so he's not surprised by this. He hear it, says he hear this every single day, you know, of these kind of cases, maybe not people not getting killed every day, but, you know, certainly beat up every day. So, you know, it's definitely happening. And so we have to ask our questions. We have to protect our young people, teach our young people, you know, a level of interaction, you know, and avoidance, you know, particularly when you're going about your everyday business. If you're not doing anything, and not to suggest that officers will not engage you and attempt to aggravate you, you just have to know to what level to escalate or de-escalate a situation, you know, because, again, no, not every law enforcement officer is looking at getting into a shootout when they come to work every day. They're not necessarily interested in, like, shooting you, you know. So the reality is that depending upon your social level and what are you doing every day? Are you just, like, hanging on a corner? You know, and not that you cannot hang on a corner, but we need builders. We need workers. You know, we need to be at work, huh? And at some I had a guy once say something, but we've been working for so long, what's more that's going to do? Well, keep working. Keep working. That's what you're going to do. That's what people do in society, in a civilized society. You're not going to sit on your butt, you know. And, yes, you can get far. You can get somewhere. And you must get somewhere if you should work or if you should try to do something. And I'll just give this example. When I got out to the Navy and had challenges with finding employment, I didn't, you know, I went 60 hours. I spent 60 hours looking for work, volunteering, working part-time. When I was working part-time, I was looking for a full-time job. Or when I was had a full-time job, I was, you know, I was volunteering. I just kept busy. You know, there was not a time I got up after 7 a.m. like the documentary says. And I would encourage everybody to get that documentary. I know Brother Bilal up in Jersey, you know, is definitely promoting that. And I wasn't able to make it up there last week for the viewing. I apologize for that. They had another viewing up there for 7 a.m., but I would encourage everybody, look at that documentary. It drops some key science, some key history on there. So, but definitely, what are you doing after 7 a.m.? I could close with that, but I'm going to say a few more things. I have 4 more minutes. I just want to thank Brother Alfred for allowing me to be on this show. I appreciate him. I don't know where he wanted me to go with this opportunity, and God willing, he'll be better. I know he wasn't feeling well today, so I appreciate him. I don't know if I addressed what he wanted me to say or what he wanted me to speak about, but I just wanted to give a strong intro, and I look forward to sharing more methodical information, key things that I'm working on that I believe sincerely, you know, can empower our community in terms of our health and our wealth, because I'm connected to some of the best and the brightest here in America, and I'm definitely, you know, heading down to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and first to Durham to, you know, be with some very powerful millionaires. I need to connect to some strong millionaires to bring solutions, to bring my knowledge, my skills, my work ethic, my commitment and conviction towards empowering you. Yes, you that are willing and ready to work. So this is Asafo, the Honorable One, Success Scholar here, Haki Shakur Ami. I want to thank you and thank Brother Alfred for giving me a call with my technical difficulties. It's my first time. I haven't hosted a blog talk by myself, actually. I'm on Harambe. Actually, I'll be on HarambeRadio.com tonight for the 11th year anniversary. For the 11th year anniversary, we'll be calling in a little bit after now. So go to HarambeRadio.com and check that out. I'll be calling in, saying a few words. But I'm hitting right down there to North Carolina. So I want to thank you. Let me give out my website one more time. And hit me up on Facebook, Haki Shakur Ami. I have two Facebook sites, and I have room for people. But also Harambe Books, Harambe Books on my Facebook. And my website, again, is successscholarhaki.com. Or I'll give out my phone number again, 410-209-9687. I'm on the road right now, so I wasn't able to adequately, fluently concentrate on some things. But I hope that I've given you a good, broad message. And, you know, go out and get my book. Get the screw out of books I've read, The New Jim Crow, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, Shock Doctrine, you know, through Amos Wilson, through Claude Anderson, Brother Jim Klingman, George Saber, if you can find his book, Dr. Joel Dudley, get all those books. And shout out to Shiki Taylor in Atlanta, Georgia, with the $1 billion march. And that's what we need. And as well as you can go to IamOneInAMillion.com, which is 1 million conscious voters and 1 million conscious contributors, those that redirect dollars into Black Pond. All of you this evening, thank you, Brother Imam, as well as to his son, and Brother Morad as well, if you're listening. Thank you, or please share this with Brother Morad. I appreciate his comments when I was in Jersey. Thank you, and good night. Peace.